Surprise.
Word of mouth becomes a lot easier the more and more specialized you get. When you're not specialized, word of mouth is extremely difficult because, you know, people are, you know, they're trying to solve a million problems every day, and your problem number 1,000,001. And so word of mouth doesn't spread.
That's my guest, Matt Kraus, talking about the relationship between narrowing your focus and word of mouth, which for him has driven huge profitability gains in his small business. I need to start with a caveat. You are going to think that I have paid an actor to get on the show and advocate for narrowing your focus. What you're going to hear Matt say lines up with everything I think you've ever heard about the benefits of narrowing your business focus. What to me is really amazing about Matt's story is how minuscule his initial market was. It was six. He narrowed his focus to the point where his target market was six companies. You heard right, six potential clients in the niche that he narrowed down to. In this interview, Matt talks about the mental and emotional blocks that you have to get through to pull off something like this and the dramatic upside that he's actually seen from doing it. One such benefit is word of mouth. I'm paraphrasing here, but Matt says the first question now out of a prospective client's mouth is, when can you start? That is very different than where he and all of the rest of us started out with, where we were probably essentially begging for work. Of course, Matt still has to qualify clients to see if they're a good fit, but the cost of sale and the difficulty of making a sale is now dramatically easier and less costly for him. I'm Philip Morgan. This is the Consulting Pipeline Podcast, where we talk about building your consulting pipeline through positioning, education-based content marketing, and marketing automation. Well, hi there, Matt. Who are you and what do you do?
Well, my name is Matt Kraus, and I am a Californian who lived many years in Washington State, and now I live in Istanbul, Turkey, and I do presentation and communications training here.
That's awesome and interesting. Can you kind of break down what presentation and training is? Like, what does that look like for your clients? What do you help them do?
What we work with, the kind of the niche that we found over the past couple of years is working with, finance companies like, you know, banks and investment portfolio companies, insurance companies. And, our main job is to, I call it taking the negative and turning it into a positive. So, the client will, you know, they'll kind of when they're talking to their audience, when they're talking to, you know, to investors or to their clients, mm-hmm. they'll frame an issue in kind of a negative way. The words that they use come across as kind of negative, or they build up sales resistance instead of, excitement in the client. And uh-huh. So our job is to help them frame the issue so that the issue will be received more positively. That's the kind of the higher level problem that we solve. The lower level tools that we use are the basic tools of presentation training. And those are, you know, things like, make eye contact, body language, PowerPoint skills, stuff like that. So there's the low level work and there's the higher level work.
Gotcha. Okay. So you have a pretty clear idea of, you know, who you're going after in terms of your clients. Was it always that way, or was that a process getting to that point?
Oh, it was definitely a process. It was absolutely not always that way. about my business partner and I, my business partner is a Turk named Alperen. He and I, we started working together about 2.5 years ago, and we were basically just working for anybody who would hire us. And we were working for the much lower market rates, and the competition was much stiffer. And we did some work for some manufacturing companies. We did some work for consumer products companies, companies selling toothpaste and mouthwash and stuff. And and then we did some work for, we even did work for some software designers at one point. So yeah, we would basically work for anybody who would give us money, and that was as of a couple of years ago.
And were you doing the same kind of services, presentation training services?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. The one thing that we found as we specialized more, we started. When you specialize more, you can charge more, and you begin playing in a field that has a whole lot less competition, and your offering becomes much less commoditized. We just kind of accidentally fell into that. I have a natural affinity for people who work in finance. And I don't know why it's been that way, or it's been that way for, all of my adult life. And I don't know why it's that way, but it just kind of happened that way. Mm-hmm. And, that came along as we wanted to get more specialized and to charge higher rates and stuff for our more specialized work. Since I have that natural affinity for people in the finance industry, that's just kind of where we landed for our more specialized work.
Okay. Yeah, I want to come back and at that same part of your story in more depth, because you're making it, you're making it sound easy. And maybe it was easy, but
it's not easy at all.
So we'll come back to that in a little more depth. I want to know first, though, how did you get started working for yourself?
I got started working for myself. It was 12 or 13 years ago, and my very first working for myself project was to import a container of galvanized wire, that was used for farmers in California. And the container of galvanized wire was from China. And so that was my background for phase one of my career, was getting stuff made in Asia and importing it into the U.S. And so that's kind of how I ended up with that being my first self-employed gig. And then I that didn't work out as a long-term business. that didn't work out. And then I tried at least 1, 2, 3 other businesses, and they didn't work out. This one, knock on wood, seems to be going well, much better than the others, knock on wood.
Wow. There's a couple things that are funny about that first business, because I assume when you say a container, you mean like a shipping container,
a 20-foot ocean shipping container, yeah.
Okay, right. So the other thing that's funny about it is I think the most common like fake business is import-export, at least in movies. So
for many years, do you remember Art Vandelay from the show, TV show? For many years, I was an Art Vandelay.
I think that in the back of my head, that's probably what I was thinking of. what a great start. So, how did you get from there to training? I assume pretty high level people within your clients' organizations. How do you get to training that kind of person? How to give a presentation?
The training that we do is mostly with the CEOs. Our kind of our niche is the CEOs of publicly traded financial institutions.
Okay.
And what I was doing before that was.
I'm going to interrupt you. I'm going to with apologies for the people listening. That's a combination, really, of an audience. So CEOs are not a market vertical per se. They're more a group of people who have something in common in that they have the same kind of job. So that's an audience combined with a market vertical, which would be finance or some segment of finance. So I'm just saying that for the benefit of listeners. You have, that's a pretty narrow focus, and we'll come back to that. You've already kind of hinted at some of the benefits of that kind of narrow focus. Anyway, you were saying how you ended up with such a specific focus.
I'll get into that, how I ended up there in a second. But
cool.
I want to, whenever you decide to come back to the subject later, I am a huge believer in a very wide world that opens up to you when you begin just this insane level of specialization. So when you come back to that subject, that's a very rich vein of that I can tap into. So I'd love to get on that subject. But you asked me how I got into the business business number three, I think, was some years ago, and I was living in Istanbul, and I was just I had closed business number two, and I was looking for something to do for business number three, and people had been telling me, for years, oh, you should teach them English, you should teach them English, and I had been resisting that for years, resisting that idea. And so I didn't have anything to do. And so I thought, okay, well, finally I'm gonna break down and I'll teach some English. And so I hung out my shingle as an English teacher, and it's teaching English is a pretty commoditized service.
Right.
And there's a lot of competition, and the competition comes from pretty much any 22-year-old kid with a backpack who's traveling around the world and is a native speaker of English. So I hung out my shingle as an English teacher and as a freelance one-on-one private lessons, and my background is in supply chain and finance. I have my professional background is in supply chain and finance. I started to attract those kinds of clients because there are very few people who can address that need. And there are very few people who can speak that language, and so I just kind of started to attract people in that niche. And since at the time I think I was 36 years old, so I had 14 years on the college graduate backpacker. And so I had 14 years of professional work experience. So I was attracting, like-minded clients. And because I was attracting like-minded clients or clients who are a little further along in their careers, and because I was offering a specialized service, I learned that I could charge higher than the average. So I started charging higher than the average. And, And it just kind of one thing led to another, and those people, you know, they work for the people who work for the people. They work. Wait. So my clients worked for the people who were the. Or wait. They worked for the people who worked for the CEOs. Uh-huh. And so then I started working for the people who worked for the CEOs, and then I started working for the CEOs. And at each step along the way, I needed to become more knowledgeable about the subject. And and also one thing that I found, I'm just kind of going to go off now on the specialization subject. Mm-hmm. One thing that I found in specializing is that specializing. First of all, it's extremely challenging creative work. You know, one of the concerns that I've read about in specializing is, and one of the concerns that I had also was that as you become more and more specialized, you do the same thing over and over, and it gets boring. And that is totally not true at all. It's actually when you begin specializing, you will probably be learning a lot of stuff that you didn't even know existed. You know, the people that I work with, you know, they've been working in the banking or insurance industries for, you know, 20 or sometimes even 30 years. And so they've, you know, for 20 and they're still learning. And mm-hmm. so for 20 or 30 years, so my clients are people who have been studying their subject for 20 or 30 years. And so for me to spend 2 years learning it, it's been a tremendous education. I think I've learned more in 2 years working in this niche than, you know, 10 years of unspecialized work.
Isn't that interesting? It's it's kind of an invigorating learning curve.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, experts kind of make things look easy, but in doing so, there's so much skill that you don't see beneath the surface, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the amount of work that that I do, if I compare now in my more specialized work, if I compare that to 2 years ago when I was doing more generalized work, mm-hmm. I still work about the same. You know, if you take, let's say, I probably work about 40 hours a week. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 2 years ago, I would be working, let's say, 30 hours facing the client and 10 hours on, you know, sharpening my saw or learning my trade or becoming better at the subject or whatever.
Right.
Now I still the total was 40 hours per week, and I still work those 40 hours per week. It's just that instead of, you know, 30 hours being client facing, maybe just 5 hours are client facing, and, you know, 35 hours will be sitting around in a cafe or you know, somewhere reading an annual report, or, you know, reading an industry report from some banking consultant. It's still 40 hours. I personally prefer the second method a lot more, because what that means is that instead of sitting in front of the client and having to be, you know, on and personable and stuff, mm-hmm. I can sit in a bar or cafe and drink a beer on a Monday afternoon and read, you know, the financial statements from a bank or something. And I totally prefer the second method, and you know, compared to the previous one.
You know, that brings up a question that I was going to ask you later on. You are obviously not billing by the hour, because, you know, if you're spending 5 hours, quote unquote, billable time, you wouldn't, your hourly rate would be much, 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 much higher, or you just would not be making as much money. So have you made any changes that make that
absolutely.
Work?
To make it work, I had to go from you know, the hourly work, which in you know, for my business, I call it the butt and seat work,
right.
Which is, you know, you have to be you get paid when you're sitting in a chair in front of the client. That's when you get paid. And if the session gets canceled, you don't get paid. So I had to go from that to a project based, or we've started to experiment a little bit with retainer based work now too.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do the project based or the retainer based work, the main thing that it required from us was to switch our focus towards what problem are we solving. You know, when you're doing hourly work, it's for us at least, it was very much, you know, a question of, okay, let's utilize our tools for a couple hours. Mm-hmm. And the tools in our instance, we're doing presentation training, mm-hmm. the tools would be, you know, the coursework of a presentation training course. Instead, in order to switch to project and retainer based work, we had to switch from, you know, hourly pay for using our tools to using those tools to solve a problem, and staying focused on, you know, what is the problem. That's the main thing that we need to do in order to stay in that space of, you know, doing project based or retainer based work.
Yeah, I also sometimes refer to that as having a solutions focus. And,
yeah,
you know, in the technology space, the phrase solution provider gets used so much that I think it kind of makes people a little queasy. But really, I mean, that's a pretty accurate description of what you are. You are a provider of a solution for a pretty specific problem.
Yeah.
And that's how you're framing your services, as it sounds to me like, is the solution to a problem rather than, you know, the input that solves that problem.
Yeah. And that, once you begin framing your service that way, it actually becomes a lot easier to sell the service, because, you know, clients don't really care how you're going to solve the problem. They just want the problem solved.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in our case, in banking and finance, it's the problem is often, you know, how do we explain this to our investors, you know, stuff like that.
Right.
They don't care, like, if you are going to fix a leaky pipe or build a car or fly an airplane or do presentation training. They don't care how you're going to solve the problem. They just want the problem solved. And if you walk into a room with a client and say, okay, well, here are the tools that we use, and why don't you pay us to use those tools? Then the client is sitting there and they're thinking, they have to do the thinking of, okay, what is my problem? Are these tools going to solve the problem? If I pay this guy to come into the room and use the tools for a while, is the problem going to go away? All of this thinking has to be done by the client. Whereas, you know, the client already knows what the problem is that they're trying to solve. If you walk into the room with a potential client, speaking the words that show them that you understand the problem and that you're going to solve the problem, they don't care how you're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
They just want the problem solved.
So a couple things I want to try to go into more there. First of all, from speaking to the generalists in the audience who say, mm-hmm. Yeah, this sounds great, but does it really work? Or can it work for me? I see it works for you, Matt. Can it work for me? Do clients really not care how it's solved? I mean, can you have a conversation where you say, you know, if you have this problem, we can help. Do you have to at any point get into how you do it? Or do they say, you know, here's a blank check. Write in whatever amount you want.
They don't give you a blank check. And they do want to know how you're going to do it. But how you're going to do it is not their primary concern.
I see.
There's this One of the other positioning websites that I like a lot, Win Without Pitching, and it's it's targeted. Are you familiar with that one?
Oh yeah, I just Blair Ends was really the original inspiration for me.
Okay.
Looking into positioning, and just like you said, if in his materials, it's like, you know, an eighth or a 16th of what he talks about. He has a really great system that he uses for helping creative agencies raise their rates, get better clients. Positioning is a part of that. It's a foundational part of it. And just like you, I found that it kind of looked like, you know, a little gopher hole in the ground, you know, a little hole about 2 or 3 inches big. And I was like, well, that's not a big subject. And then you go into it and there's this cavernous network of topics and interesting things that all that you find, you know, only by going through that little tiny hole.
I want to get to that in a second too, but back to your earlier question about you know what it is does the client write you a blank check? And one of the things that Blair Ends talks about is he talks about what does he call them case process framed case studies is I think the phrase that he uses.
Okay.
And his, I think what his main point there is a process framed case study is where you show the client in the past this is how we solved a very similar problem for one of our other clients.
Mm-hmm.
And so the client wants, I mean, the client is not writing you a blank check. The client wants to know that, okay, this guy that I'm about to give a large chunk of money to this guy, he's seen this problem before, and this is what the process is going to look like. You know, the client needs that bit of comforting. You know, late in the sales cycle.
Right.
But the primary is, I think that one mistake that a lot of generalists seem to be using is certainly in our industry, and it looks like they do it in other industries too. Generalists tend to focus on the tools that they're using and their skills in implementing those tools, and clients. Their primary focus is this is my problem and I want this problem solved. When they look at you and your box of tools, their first thought when they look at you is, will this guy be able to solve this problem? Can he speak the language of this problem? Does he understand me when I talk? And I have this vague notion that the tools that he uses are going to help solve the problem, but the client is not sitting there wondering, okay, is this guy the best, you know, the most skilled user of the tools that exists in the whole world? That's not the client's concern at all.
Right. It's a bit like if you took your car in for repairs and the mechanic said, sure, why don't you come on over here? And then they lay out about, you know, 50 different tools and they then look at you and say, okay, you know, what do you think? Where should we, begin? Should we undo this part first?
Exactly.
Or do you think maybe we should start over here?
I find that, that actually almost always, clients will have, an idea, a self-diagnosed idea of what the problem is. And almost always, that will not be the main problem. And at first, when I started seeing things this way, I had a confidence difficulty about speaking up and saying, well, actually, no, I think you're misdiagnosing the problem. I think that the real solution is not A, it's B. And
how did you deal with that confidence issue? Because I know that's very common, you know, especially as you kind of move up the food chain, you start dealing with people higher up in the organization.
Yeah.
Having the confidence to say, exactly what you said. You know, maybe yeah, that's not really the problem. What did you do to get over that?
I tend to have fairly high levels of confidence that I've, you know, developed over the years in, uh-huh. in other aspects of life.
Yeah.
So I just tapped into that spirit. It wasn't, there was no like specific faith in, you know, my particular line of work. It was just a generalized confidence. And in that, one of the first times that I ever had that conversation, it was with the CEO of one of the largest companies in the country. And so I thought, man, as soon as I opened my mouth, this guy is totally going to chop my head off.
Right.
And he's going to laugh while he chops me into little pieces. And I opened my mouth and I started speaking, and it rocked his world. I wasn't expecting that at all, but I saw before my very eyes, the guy was like, wow, you understand the problem. Like, you understand the problem in ways that I didn't even know existed. We've had that experience a number of times where specializing our business, where I'll just be thinking of me and usually my business partner too, we'll be thinking, man, as soon as we say this, they're going to totally realize how ridiculous and unfounded it is, and how we're total fakers and we have no right to be in the room. We have no right to be talking like this. Who do we think we are? And we'll open our mouths and they'll be like, wow, that's the most brilliant thing we ever heard. And we've been doing that, you know, for over a year, and it still throws us for a loop every time. And you know, as far as pricing goes, sometimes we'll charge a higher price for something than we think is warranted. Mm-hmm. And the higher price will just get accepted without any negotiation at all. And we'll think, wow, next time we need to be able, make sure we charge more.
Yeah. Right. Remember that.
So it's just, I think there's no magic key to getting that confidence. You just have to start with whatever small step works for you. Wherever your comfort zone ends, just go, you know, half a step out of that, and then you'll realize that, wow, I thought I was going to get killed. I'm still alive. The sun still comes up in the morning. Tomorrow I'm going to go out of my comfort zone again and just do it a half a step at a time. And it'll take a while. It might take a couple of years, but you'll be so glad you did.
Yeah. How do you get work primarily? New business, not repeat business.
There are two main ways. One is word of mouth, and that's the main way that we get business, actually. And word of mouth becomes a lot easier the more and more specialized you get. When you're not specialized, word of mouth is extremely difficult because you know, people are, you know, they're trying to solve a million problems every day, and your problem number a million and one, and so word of mouth doesn't spread. But when you're very specialized, you know, person in industry, in your industry, person A will hear person B speaking, and person B will be saying, hey, I'm trying to solve this problem. And person A will think, wow, there's one guy I know who can solve that problem, and that guy is blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And then person B calls you up, and they don't even ask questions. They'll just be like, hey, I have a problem XYZ, and I hear you can solve it. I hear you're the only guy in town who can solve it. So can you help me out?
Go ahead.
That's method number one, word of mouth, which is, you know, probably 70% of our business or more. Another way that we get business is by we hold seminars for that are kind of quasi public access.
Okay.
They are for our clients or friends of our clients, and the one of the there's a little educational content. You know, one of us will be standing up in front of the room talking about something, but the main benefit for the clients, I think, is that they get to network with each other. And they love it because they get to network with each other. People have a natural, human beings have a natural desire to connect with human beings, and provide them with an opportunity to do that. And they'll just start, they'll associate your business with something good in their life. And so when they have a problem, they'll be happy to call you.
Interesting. So back to the word of mouth, I'm curious if you can, you know, taking out names and identifying details, but can you kind of walk through a word of mouth scenario? Because here's what I'm afraid people are maybe thinking when they hear you talking about word of mouth. They're thinking, someone runs out into the street and just yells Matt Krause over and over again, and you know, you must hire Matt Krause. And that's not what word of mouth is, but I fear that a lot of us have a sort of cartoonish idea of how it works. And so I'm wondering if you can kind of, you know, paint in the details a little bit more about how that has worked for you.
It's word of mouth is very much a one-on-one personal exchange. And, you know, I'll do work for person A, and person A will love what that work is doing for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he'll introduce me to his best friend who works in a different company in a similar industry. And so he'll introduce me to person B, and then person B will become my client because, you know, friends who work in similar industries face very similar problems. And so it becomes extremely easy to sell to person B. In fact, you don't even with word of mouth, you don't even have to do the selling. The client A, person A, will do the selling. And so basically you just take out your calendar for person B and say, when would you like to start?
Right.
And then person A or person B will introduce you to person C, and person C will be either be a client of person A or B, or a friend of person A or B, or something like that. So word of mouth, I used to think that word of mouth was a much looser thing where, the distance between person A and person B would be like maybe they were casual friends and maybe they talked to each other once or twice. But actually, I've found that the most successful word of mouth comes from people who hang out on an almost weekly basis. And when you're very specialized, that word of mouth will be very valuable.
Mm-hmm. Couple of questions to kind of tie back to things we mentioned earlier. So you said, you know, when you were more in the generalist mode of operating, you had an affinity for people who are now your target market. How did you notice that? Did you know these people socially? Did you have one or two clients in the financial services industry, and that was your clue that this was an interesting market? Something else. How did you first notice that affinity?
How I first noticed it was almost by accident. I was back in business number two, So let's say that if the current one, if presentation training is business number three, mm-hmm. Business number two, which was the teaching English, I started to realize that, or kind of one day or over the space of a couple of weeks, I started to realize that, oh, wait a minute, 80% of my clients are from banks, and the other 20% are from consumer product supply chain, mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to do anything. It's just kind of happening that way. Mm-hmm. And so when it came time for us to specialize in business number three with the presentation training, I thought back to business number two and thought, oh, wait, for some reason, I'm not quite sure why, but for some reason, I seem to have a natural affinity for these people. And so this is where we're going to plant our stake in the ground in the financial services area.
When you did that?
So it was just kind of an accidental thing.
I see. When you did that, did you feel like that there was any risk that you were taking a risk, or, I mean, did you have to get through any kind of emotional stuff to follow through on that decision?
Yeah. Again, it is kind of a leap of faith, and like you were describing earlier, you know, the Blair Ends thing, and how specializing is kind of like it looks like a gopher hole, and then you get inside and you realize that it's a huge cavern.
Yeah.
You know, when a couple of years ago when we started working together for business number three. You know, we were generalists, and we thought, oh, you know, the whole world is our oyster. every human being wants to, you know, communicate with other people, and we would, you know, be talking to, you know, somebody from company XYZ, and they would say, oh yeah, we do presentations all the time, and my business partner and I would think, oh, the world is our oyster. They right. do presentations all the time. Oh my God, we're just basically swimming in demand here. And then all of a sudden, or not all of a sudden, but for us, it was over the space of a year or so, where we realized, okay, in order to raise our rates, we're going to need to specialize. And so we started specializing and specializing more and more and more until we were specializing, you know, in a market that only has probably about six companies in it. And
are you saying, I'm sorry to interrupt, you're saying six clients that you could work with, or six other, you know, five other vendors and you?
Six clients, six potential clients. And actually, now that we get into it and start seeing the cavern, that six becomes a lot more. But at the time, it looked like about six clients. And, you know, so in this transition, we went from this, oh, the world is our oyster, our market is everybody. Oh my God, the world is so big. There are 7 billion people. There'll be work for the rest of our lives. And, and then, you know, over the space of a year, we started specializing, and then all of a sudden there were only six potential clients, and we were both like, oh my God, you know what, the world is so small now, what are we going to do? But
right.
once you start specializing, you become one of the only people who can address that industry, and
right.
and Most industries are actually quite huge. You know, you might see from where you're standing now, you might, in our case, you might see only, you know, six companies. But once you start working with those six companies, you realize, oh my God, those six companies, they work with 18 other companies. And so then all of a sudden there's 24 companies. And and then you realize, and there's a great saying that I like. I think it comes from either Blair Ends or somebody that he works with in the creative services positioning market. David C. Baker, Recourses. Have you ever heard of him?
Okay. Yes.
So,
yes.
So I don't know if I think it's probably one of the two of them, but there's this saying that I like, experts travel, and their admonition is that if most of your business is local, then you're probably not specializing enough. So, you know, we see these six companies here in Istanbul, and then we start getting into the cavern and realize, oh, those six companies, they work with 18 other companies, and now there's 24 companies in Istanbul, and then you have the skill set that that people start to find, and then you realize that, oh, we're not just working in Istanbul now, we can work in Amsterdam, or we can work in New York, or we can work in anywhere else in the world. Anywhere there's somebody in our niche, in our case, mm-hmm. our niche is financial companies. And so then all of a sudden, now the world is your oyster. And where, you know, a few months ago, it looked like there was just six companies. Now there's like this whole world of companies, and you can serve them a lot better because you understand their problems in a way that a generalist never will.
Yeah, you're almost describing what sounds like an optical illusion in how we perceive an opportunity. It's like we see.
Oh yeah.
I think of the Flatiron Building in New York City, which is this really long, narrow wedge-shaped building. And if you were at a certain point on the street, it just would look like a little tiny building. But it's actually quite large when you really understand the shape of it. And it sounds like something similar happened with you.
Yeah, I think that the idea that if you specialize, first of all, specializing requires a huge amount of learning and a lot of creativity. I will not tell anybody that it's easy. I would never say in a million years that specializing is easy. You'll have to do a lot of work to do it.
Right.
But this fear, that this very common fear that that your world will actually become smaller, that is totally wrong. I mm-hmm. disagree with that entirely.
Well, and as you suggested earlier, it's not easier, but it does redistribute how you apply your effort, because you know when you're telling me that 70% of your work comes from word of mouth, that mm-hmm. basically other people selling for you who also you don't have to pay. In fact, they pay you. That's pretty efficient from a sales and marketing perspective. And so I know that generalists, because I was one for, around 5 years, sometimes don't have to do a lot of selling, but they do hit that panic button every once in a while and sit down and, burn 10, 20 hours trying to hustle up the next job. And you're not doing that at all, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's the sales for us, the sales has gone from in 2 years, it's gone from a process of, thank God somebody called us. Oh, let's go try to prove to them that we're worthy. That was our positioning, two years ago. And now our positioning is, person A recommended us to person B. Let's go talk to person B and see if we're going to be able to find any room for this person at all. So the nature of the sales game, or the frame that you use to represent the sales game to yourself, that will change dramatically, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Matt, this has been a super fascinating conversation, and
I've enjoyed it too.
Thank you. I know people are maybe going to think that I set you up as a shill to shill for positioning, but really, you're someone who's on my mailing list, and we started emailing back and forth, and it just became apparent that you have a really interesting story, and you kind of arrived at this through your own investigations of what would work and what wouldn't work for your business.
Yeah.
So I think it's a really cool story. How can people find out more about you, or if they have questions about positioning, maybe, how could they ask you directly?
Yeah, my my website is mattkrause.com, mattkrause.com. And that's my personal website. And there are up on the top of the page, you know, there's the menu bar, and the menu bar has a link to my business websites and some other stuff, I think. But mattkrause.com is the hub where you can always find me. It's been that way for, you know, 15 years. And also, I would be happy to talk to any of your listeners who want to contact me directly by email or Skype or whatever. So any of your listeners, or if you want to follow up, I'm always happy to talk about the subject.
That's great. Well, Matt, thank you so much for your insight and for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, and thanks for having me.
That's it for this episode of the Consulting Pipeline Podcast. Thanks again to my guest, Matt Krause. You can find Matt online at mattkrause.com. Just a brief show note. Matt approached me after season one had wrapped. So this episode is really a sort of interstitial episode as far as my season structure for my podcast goes. I hope you really enjoyed it. I am still working on season two, which is around the theme of content marketing for time or resource constrained consultants. I think we're looking at a mid to late spring 2016 launch date for season two. If you're on my list, you'll get a heads up, of course. And if you're not on my list, head over to positioningcrashcourse.com and sign up there for a nice free email course on positioning, and you will get integrated into my list in short order. While you're waiting for season two, if you have enjoyed or benefited from this program, please leave a note in iTunes or tell your business buddies about it. To leave a review, search the iTunes store for Consulting Pipeline Podcast, click on the podcast cover art, click ratings and reviews, click the rightmost of the gray stars next to click to rate, and if you're feeling extra generous, click write a review button and leave a short positive review. You can find more episodes of this podcast at consultingpipelinepodcast.com. I'm Philip Morgan, and I hope to see you next time.